Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear some in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting U.S. and global economies. My name is Ben Miller. I am CEO and co-founder of Fundrise. Today's episode is being recorded on October 25th, 2022. Before we get started, we just want to thank all of you who've rated and reviewed the show in your podcast apps. Also, I want to remind you that this podcast is not investment advice, and it is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. We have a special guest today, Ben Carlson, who is Director of Institutional Asset Management at Ritholtz Wealth Management, which has $2.7 billion under management. He's been managing institutional portfolios for his entire career, including for foundations, endowments, pension funds, insurance companies, etc. He's the author of 4 books about money and hosts a well-known podcast called Animal Spirits. Ben, welcome to Onward.
Nice to be on the other side of this with you here.
Yeah. Okay, so let's jump in. State of affairs in the world today. There's a lot of dissonance in the market at the moment between the real economy and the financial economy. So here, how do you think about what's happening today and what sort of discrepancies are you seeing that are strange to you or interesting?
I think in a word, the economy and the markets are just weird right now. We're in a very weird place. There are so many cross currents. If you wanted to look at certain pieces of data that told you the economy is in big trouble, you could easily find those. If you wanted to look at other pieces that say, no, actually things are still humming along okay, you could find those too. So I think depending on where you look and what you're looking at, you could get just totally conflicting pieces of evidence. So obviously inflation has been running at 40-year highs for a while now, for well over a year. We haven't tested this for a while, but people really hate inflation. The consumer sentiment numbers, all this stuff, people just cannot stand uncertainty in their prices and seeing changes that happen that fast. That's actually surprised me the most out of everything from this is just I didn't know how people would react to inflation. And obviously the reaction generally from the public is we hate this.
Yeah, I never experienced it, right? 40 years ago.
Yeah, prices going up, people kind of bake that into their expectations. Prices going up this much and having this many problems with supply chains and getting things they want and finding cars or houses or semiconductors or whatever they're looking for, people just, I think, maybe underappreciated how much convenience was baked into our entire system that got just totally upended in the last couple of years. So it's a weird spot. But on the other hand, you have unemployment rate way back to where it was pre-pandemic, right? It's well below 4%. It went up to over 14%, spiked there in about a two-month period at the beginning of the pandemic. Now we've had one of the quickest job recoveries ever from that point. There are still more jobs available than there are people looking for jobs right now, if you include people in the labor force. That number is coming down, but that's a weird thing. People are able to negotiate much higher wages. The Atlanta Fed looks at this data and they break wages out into people who are changing jobs and people who are staying at jobs. And the people who are changing jobs are seeing the fastest rises in their wages. So you can get a bigger wage raise if you change jobs because you have better negotiating power now since it's harder for employers to find jobs. Then on the other hand, the Fed is basically telling us, it's like bright neon lights. We are going to send the economy into recession. It's basically everyone, if you haven't predicted it yet, you're behind because the majority of people for months now have seen this coming. Like there's going to be an economic slowdown. I think even if we went back into a more normalized phase of consumer spending and all this other stuff, just from the bump in the pandemic, that probably would have led to a slowdown. Now the Fed is stepping in and they're raising rates at a very fast clip to get the inflation down. And so you have all this stuff where it feels like a recession is coming at some point, but people still have jobs, their incomes are going up, and they're still spending money. If you're in an airport one of these days, the airports are just bustling with people, right? Go to Disney, theme parks are packed, restaurants and bars are packed. It doesn't feel like a recession in certain parts of the economy because consumers are still spending, but it's a weird place where everyone is anticipating that coming and we're just waiting for the bad stuff to happen. So we're in a very weird place where a lot of times in the past, we didn't know we were in a recession until we already, like technically it wasn't a recession until we were already in one. People wouldn't really know. Right now, people kind of know there's a recession coming at some point. Some people think we're already in one. Some people think it's 2023. So that's why this situation is so bizarre, because you can get a job if you want one, and that doesn't seem like a recession. But inflation is at 8 or 9%, and people are just worried about what happens next because the Fed is raising rates so fast.
Great setting the table, because I'm out in financial markets. We're buying asset-backed securities. We're talking to all the sales coverage at the big investment banks. We're really close to the financial markets, and financial markets are like breaking.
Yes. Like,
they are really fragile. I think we're going to start seeing like actual breakage soon. And it's strange, the discrepancy between the financial markets and the real economy. And I was trying to think back when the last time capital did poorly, but labor did well.
Right. It's been a long time.
Yeah. Because usually, like last decade, capital did great. Asset prices were up 300%. And from 2008 to 2020, right, there was like sort of jobless recovery and wages were flat and people were a lot of like populist anger. So now you're seeing the opposite policies, right? All the policies have gone in reverse. We went from quantitative easing to quantitative tightening, went from zero interest rates to high interest rates. And I kind of wonder, like, is the actual outcome the opposite of what we saw last decade? So what you're saying is weird is actually the new normal.
Right. And I think to your point about stuff breaking, I don't think that the system is set up for really fast changes. The U.S. economy is this $23 trillion behemoth that it's like turning a battleship. It takes a while. So the fact that we're seeing rates go up so fast and mortgage rates go from 3% at the beginning of the year to more than 7% now, and treasury rates go from 1% to 4% or 5%. And the fact that it's happened so fast, we didn't get this like stair-step approach where people could slowly but surely anchor to new levels and get used to it. It's really uncomfortable. And people, we know from history, just human nature, people don't like change very much. So I don't think people have a sense yet of the changes that are coming and how this could impact them in the future. Because I think a lot of this stuff in the economy happens on a lag. Like we're going to start seeing the data slow. And you saw housing markets today slow where the prices rolled over a little bit. And a lot of that data is backward looking and it's going to take some time to filter through to the real economy. And I think that's the weird part is that the financial markets have kind of gotten ahead of it, but doesn't seem like anyone really cares that the stock market is down 25 or 30% right now in terms of their spending, because people still have jobs and they have income and they don't like inflation, but it's at a bizarre place where the financial markets have gotten ahead of this and are getting ahead of it, but it still feels weird because we haven't had the economic downturn to go hand in hand with that. So a lot of people are worried, well, okay, maybe the stock market front ran all of this stuff and it's pricing it in. On the other hand, do things just get worse if and when we do see an actual slowdown in the data?
Right. So our team was at the Asset-Backed Securities Conference in Miami. And that's basically like the behind the scenes where all debt just gets moved. So any mortgage or like consumer credit, all of it gets moved through these, not that many people. And so when it comes to the change you're talking about, all of these sort of like pipes were filled because 2021 was just really hot market. So they were filled with stuff that was supposed to get moved. And now it's hitting the financial markets and the financial markets have just totally repriced. So these like movers or originators are sitting on like hundreds of billions of dollars. Like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac alone, I think are sitting on $150 billion of mortgages they originated that they have to turn around and securitize into a completely different market. So that's one of the downsides of the rapid change. And the financial markets are still like, they have not yet processed that. It's still lagging. So that's going to happen over the next sort of 2 quarters. And that's why we're at the Asset-Backed Securities Conference to sort of do our part. But yeah, I kind of think that there's sort of this thing that we think of as weird persists for longer, that basically financial markets get punished for a while, like maybe 5 years, three to five, lot longer because of quantitative tightening and debt crisis. And there's just a labor shortage.
Yeah. And we're not letting as many people into the country that could potentially fill some of those jobs. But I think, yeah, we haven't had to deal with, you know, these rates right now at 4 to 5%. If you look back historically, you'd think, well, that's kind of average. But we haven't dealt with that for 15 years, mm-hmm. at least. And before mm-hmm. that, rates were falling and not rising. So I think there's a difference. So if you look at any of the research for the stock market, typically, you know, on average, these aren't perfect numbers, but when inflation is rising or high, stock market tends to perform poorly. When it's falling or low, then it performs much better. Same thing with interest rates. If they're rising or high, it's not quite as good. If they're low and falling, it's much better. And so the Fed stuff does take a lag, right? In the past, it could take 2, 3, 4 years for inflation to fall back down to levels that they want. It's not like it happens overnight. Mm-hmm. These things could take time. Right. And it's not like all the corporations that have raised prices because of supply chain problems and higher wages, they're not going to reverse those prices. Those are going to be sticky. They're going to take it to their margins if they can. And so it's not like prices are just all the way going to fall down back to 2019 levels immediately. So it could take a few years. And if the Fed decides this is not happening as quickly as we like, and we're going to keep our foot on the brakes and keep rates at 4 or 5% for a while, even if that's like the terminal level for a little bit, you're right. It's a totally different market. And I think for investors, that's because there's finally some competition. There's no more TINA market, and retirees have been complaining for years. I've got nowhere with a safe yield to put my money. And now there's competition for stocks. You could get 6% in corporate bonds and 4-5% in treasuries and up to 8-9% in high yield now. Mm-hmm. And when you have that competition for the first time in a while, that could change how investors view risk in a big way.
I think of you as a kindred spirit. So you're like a wary of hype and a bit of a skeptic. Where in your background, so what experiences got you to become so skeptical?
I like to think of it more as realistic, but I was never like a born salesperson. Like I know people who are just, they can talk to anyone. They can sell the proverbial catch a popsicle to a woman wearing white gloves, that sort of thing. That was never me. I was always more of an analytical person, numbers driven kind of data approach. So I started out with endowments and foundations and pensions. And I started there in like 2004, 2005. And so I saw all the run up that happened before the great financial crisis and then the aftermath of that. And that was in the formative years of my investment career. And what I saw is at the beginning, I was really impressed with how many brilliant people there were in that space. Because we're talking, you know, billion-dollar funds, multi-billion-dollar funds. They're mm-hmm. investing in the best stuff, hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, all this stuff. And at first, I was blown away by, geez, these people are so much smarter than me. They know way more than I do. And I just want to learn from them. And I was blown away. And the further along I went, and I saw the crisis happen in the aftermath, and I saw these people doing like the opposite of what I thought was prudent investing, is they're like taking risk off the table in like early 2009. And going into more like defensive hedge fund strategies. And I'm wondering, like, the stock market is already down 50%. Call me crazy, but buying into risk assets that are just getting slaughtered seems like a pretty good idea to me. And a lot of these people were doing the opposite thing, mainly because of, I think, career risk more than their lack of intelligence, fortitude as an investor. And so I think a lot of the really smart people I saw were better at sales and telling a good story than they were at the financial markets themselves. So I started becoming a little weary of people in the world that were just too smart and seemed like they had all the answers. Because that's what it seemed like to me at the beginning is, geez, this smart person seems like they have all the answers. They know what's going to happen next. Their predictions and their stories sound great. And then you see what actually happens and you realize, oh, this person, they were telling a good story, but they were telling it because they were talking their own book or they don't know as much as they think. And sometimes the people who have the loudest microphone aren't necessarily the people who know what's going to happen next or are good at this. So I probably met too many smart people who I saw being wrong over and over again for the first 10 years of my career. And one of the things people did in that space was just making things overly complex. Mm-hmm. And so I always thought, especially in a complex world like the financial markets, it probably makes more sense to simplify than it does to fight complexity with complexity, because the world is a crazy place and weird things can happen. And the financial markets are this ever-evolving, complex, adaptive system. But maybe trying to make things more complex to fight complexity only makes things worse. And that's kind of what I landed on, is that less is often more and simple is better than complex when trying to understand what's going on with this stuff.
Yeah, I didn't realize how much of a parallel experience we had. I came out a little earlier than you. I got the 99 to 01 period, but like I went through that run up where I was learning 2004 and 5 and 6, and I was just blown away by the sophistication of the people. And then, yeah, then everything turned out to be a sham. So maybe we just had a generation of people had the same experience and came away very dubious of the establishment.
Yeah.
And that was like a scarring experience, right? It's like the pandemic, it was this scarring experience as well. And people who didn't live it, it's hard for people to see it as scarring because afterwards, asset prices went up so much.
And I actually think living through the 2008 financial crisis, like I took a job at a large endowment fund in like the summer of 2007, right as stuff was really starting to break. Mm-hmm. And living through that whole experience, I actually think that was a positive thing for me. And I think sometimes these experiences can lead you down to two different paths. Like I saw a lot of brains get broken following a financial crisis, and they all wanted to be the next Big Short person. They want to find that next thing. And they spent the next 10 years trying to find the Big Short without realizing that those kind of once in a lifetime trades come along once in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of times you can take the wrong lessons from those kind of experiences. But I'm actually glad that I lived through the 2008 financial crisis that early in my career, because I think it really, it helped me calibrate the idea of like anything can really happen in markets and the whole risk side of things and reward. Like obviously you saw these huge returns coming off of the bottom of the crisis, but you had to live through 18 months of hell to get there. And so understanding the pain that can be felt in financial markets and how dispiriting it can be, I think it was really helpful for me to see both sides of that coin.
So actually, sort of does team me up. So you've written four books, right? And some of them are basically history books in a way. I love people who study history. So having written so many books about history, what stories do you look back on, you know, whether it's your story or things you just saw, you feel like were either like super informative to you or are really applicable today?
I came out of school not knowing very much about the financial markets. I was never one of those people. You hear the stories about the people who say, hey, I was reading the Wall Street Journal or Barron's with my dad every weekend when I was 10 years old and picking stocks. That was never me. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I got into finance and backed into it. And I realized when I was talking to all these smart people that I just don't know a lot. And I do think one of the best ways you can learn is to study history. And I don't think it makes sense to help try to figure out if you're going to be the next Warren Buffett or something like that. I know a lot of people go down that rabbit hole when they first get into this stuff, but I found studying financial market history way more informative. Mm-hmm. And the thing that most financial market history is written on is the booms and the busts. And I think that's the one thing that is constant over time. Like the market structure is constantly changing, and the way people invest and the technology involved and how the ease of access and all these things are changing, and definitely for the better in my view, especially for individual investors. But the one constant across time, even when different economic environments and different regime changes and all this stuff and politicians and everything that's different about certain times, it's human nature is the one constant. That's one of the things that if I look back on it now, I studied finance and economics and business management in college, but if I would have done it all over again, I would probably have started behavioral psychology, because that's the big thing about the markets is just understanding human nature and how people react to different situations when things are really good and they're so greedy, and when things are really bad, they're so fearful and all this stuff. That's the biggest thing to me, is just understanding how the human brain reacts to these different scenarios. And that's why the pendulum is always swinging a little too far in both directions, mm-hmm. probably because we can't help ourselves but take things too far. And you've seen that in the last 3 years, right? You've seen, it feels like we've had 6 different cycles, and every one of them has felt like it's gone a little too far. And that's just because we can't help ourselves.
Yeah. The way I think of it is that, like, you can only learn so much in your lifetime, but you can basically like read history and biography and get other people's lifetimes and get more reference points. And so it's about collecting as many reference points as possible, so you can basically have like, you know, more data and make better decisions. And so that's like history and biography, like, gives you that in a way that sort of nothing other than basically your own life, right?
Well, what do they say? Standing on the shoulders of giants. I especially like to read history that was written at the time too, because, or in and around that time, like books about the Great Depression that were written in the 30s or 40s, right? As opposed to someone now looking back, because I think our view of history can change over time, sometimes in the positive, sometimes in the negative. But if you read about what people were saying back then at the time who were experiencing it, I think you can get an even better view of it. So there's this one book called like The Great Depression, A Diary. And this guy found his grandfather's diary from the Great Depression. And it was from like the 1930 to 1937. And this guy would journal what was going on. And you could see in real time how he was feeling about the stock market or real estate market or the job market or the economy. And it was so fascinating to see how people felt then, like, this is the bottom. And then 3 months later, okay, that definitely wasn't the bottom, and all this stuff. So I think if you can get sort of a boots in the ground view too, that's just as interesting as someone who's a historian going back and trying to piece together after the fact.
Yeah. I think you must have read this book like Since Yesterday.
Yes.
Another good one like
one
that.
One of my, Frederick Lewis Allen, one of my favorite authors, by the way, from that time period especially.
He wrote one about the 20s and then one about the 30s.
Yes.
And both were really good. Okay, so do you have like any specific stories that come to mind? I feel like in the books you've written, you have these vignettes that I think are really just great ways to actually like consume learning.
Yeah, so the one book I wrote that was called Don't Fall For It, which is a short history of financial fraud. I read all these stories about financial fraud going back to like the 1500s. And the funniest thing is, just like financial markets, is the scams themselves were all pretty similar, right? A lot of times, the people with the biggest target on their back are the people with the most money. And there was all these different ways that you would get rich people to basically hand over their money. I think the funniest one was this guy would go to a fancy hotel in town, and he would talk at the bar about how he had this surefire way to recreate $100 bills by this magic box that he created. And he got these rich people up in his hotel room, and he'd show them. He'd say, the only problem is it takes 3 hours to produce. So let's turn the machine on. I'll show you how it works. We'll go down, we'll have a drink at the bar, we'll come back in 3 hours and see how it looks. And 3 hours later, this machine would spit out a $100 bill that looked exactly like a $100 bill. And the rich people were just blown away. And they'd say, I want to buy this machine from you. He'd say, I don't want to sell it. It's worth so much. And they'd say, no, what? Name your price. And they'd pay him thousands of dollars for this machine that could spit out $100 bills. And then they'd hit the button to do another one. And by that time, he had 3 hours to get away. And the people didn't realize is that this machine actually just spit out a real $100 bill, and that's all it could do. But the rich people at the time, his whole point was like, they want to believe that this kind of thing is available to them. Surely this sounds too good to be true, but it has to be available to someone like me who has the money and has the means. And that's the thing that I thought was funny over and over again. The people who are most likely to be taken advantage of are not like the rubes you would think of, like, oh, this person is naive, they know nothing, they don't have any money. No, it's the people who have a lot of money, but they're overconfident in their own abilities to like suss this stuff out. They would want to think like, oh, there's a secret door for me because I'm so wealthy. And that's when those people get themselves into trouble and get some sort of Bernie Madoff or Ponzi scheme.
So actually, I have a firsthand experience with that. So it was 2004-ish. And I was in the room with this wealth management firm. I'm not going to name names, but they were basically selling a product that was extremely stable. They always had 10% yield. And they just showed all this data, and it was really sophisticated. And it was in New York. It was a who's who of New Yorkers, owners of sports teams, and just really sophisticated co-investors. And so that people said, well, I don't understand this, but I can see who else is doing it. And it's like, who's who? And I feel like privileged to get in. And I remember sitting in the room and being like, well, why isn't anybody asking, like, something's not right. Just something's not right. They're doing too nice to you. And it was Bernie Madoff. It was Madoff. But I was in the room watching the sale happen. And it's so many times, this is like an operating principle of the company I've been trying to teach, but people don't see, people are satisfied with surface answers.
Well, you mentioned the peer stuff, like seeing other rich people, this idea of social proof, that's like the Robert Cialdini thing. He wrote the six principles of influence and persuasion. Social proof is such a big one where if you think, well, other rich people are going to be in that, so why wouldn't I? Because you saw when they named who was in that, it's big name actors and actresses and some of these big foundations. And that was interesting. When I studied Madoff for my book a little bit too. My favorite story there was a guy who wrote a book, and he was like the foremost author and an expert on human gullibility. And in December 2008, he came out with a book. And this is like my life's work of studying human gullibility. And it came out December 2008, the very same month Madoff's Ponzi scheme came to light, right? Mm-hmm. And it turned out, and this guy wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal kind of explaining this, and credit to him for doing it, but the guy who literally wrote the book on human gullibility was an investor in one of Madoff's feeder funds. And he said, I didn't do a whole lot of due diligence. I just saw that there were other rich people in that, and I followed some friends into it. And so this idea of social proof that if it's good enough for them, it has to be good enough for me without doing your own thought process and your own research on it, that is a big thing that more people do that you'd probably be surprised about.
Okay, so here, I'm going to tee you up for a curveball here. In the book, you define a scam as the promise of high returns without the substance of real product, income, or an asset. So under that definition, so how is cryptocurrency different?
Well, one of the things I've learned in this business is that oftentimes you could be the smartest person in the world. You could have all the data you wanted. You could be able to research and perform discounted cash flow analysis and have the highest IQ in the room. But if you can't tell a good story, then it doesn't really matter. I think the person with the best story typically wins. And I think the best explanation of something just like Bitcoin is that it's like kind of a digital religion. And I think that case, because it has a good story and it has a good backing in terms of a good story, that's probably one of the reasons that it became so popular so quickly, because people in the technology space see how fast things are moving in that space and how much progress we're making. And I think that's part of it. And obviously people see a line go up a lot and then they jump on as well. But I think that's probably the best explanation without being able to see some utility for it. And the other thing about crypto is the narrative has just changed a lot over time. That's probably the most surprising thing. If you wanted to look for like a bullish case in a really bearish crypto winter that we're in right now, like crypto's down 70% or whatever Bitcoin is, I think the most bullish thing about it is just the fact that it hasn't died, because it falls 60, 70, 80% once every few years, it seems. And the narrative is constantly changing and people are picking up. At first it was, you know, we're all going to buy pizza and Starbucks with crypto, right? It's going to mm-hmm. be a medium mm-hmm. exchange. And that quickly went away, because why would you spend something that is going up 10,000% a year? That makes no sense. You're losing out of money. So why don't you just hold it? Then it became this macro thing where it's going to be this, okay, it's a store of value, but it's also, because we have this digital scarcity, it's going to be an inflation hedge. And then you had the macro people latched on it. The dollar is going to collapse and crypto is going to overtake the dollar and cryptocurrencies are going to rule the world, because you can produce as many dollars as you want, but crypto is, there's a scarcity to it. I don't know how far that one goes, because you can just recreate as many cryptocurrencies as you want, but that was the idea. And obviously we've seen over the last year and a half, the exact opposite situation. I think it's probably more of a technology startup than anything. And it's a very long duration asset. And it's trading 24/7 and it's liquid. It's almost an asset that was made to crash on occasion. Like the booms and the busts, it's set up perfectly for that. Right. There is no cash flow. I guess the counter would be gold has been around for thousands of years as a store of value. The one example I've heard is back when Jesus walked the earth, an ounce of gold could buy a fine men's suit, and it can do the same today. So you'd say, well, it's kept up with inflation over thousands of years, even if it hasn't added much value. And sometimes human faith is just as strong as a discounted cash flow analysis. But that's why if you're trying to put a price target on something like that, though, I don't know how you could try to have a model for something like that where you're trying to model out human nature and faith and what people are willing to pay for something in the future. Because you're right, there's no dividends, there's no income, there's no yield, that there's nothing like that on anything that can give you any sort of confidence that you're going to be able to pick a number out of thin air and that's what's going to be in a few years.
The most persuasive for me is that is a store of value and is a new kind of store of value because it's so accessible and liquid and global where nothing else. If you're buying gold, you're actually buying gold. You're buying some derivative of gold on the market. But I also look at it to segue back to the market is a kind of a psychological outcome of quantitative easing.
Yeah, I do think the 2008, the fact that it came out of that, and I think so many people had this aversion to big financial institutions and hey, they bailed out the bankers and I don't want that to happen to me. And so I do think that came out at the perfect time for something like that to happen.
Yeah. So, okay. So one of the things that I like to do on the business side and I've done on this podcast is scenario planning. Because if you're investing, you're hiring, you're building software, whatever it is you're doing, you ultimately have to be doing it against some base scenario. So how do you think about the next like year or two? I mean, I don't want to say forecast, but like upside, downside, baseline type scenarios.
Well, yeah, I try not to make huge forecasts in terms of what the market is going to do. You're spot on in terms of like thinking in a range of possibilities, right? You have to have some sort of baseline because you have to set expectations, especially with clients. The stock market is much more likely to go up 20% in a given year than it is to be down. But when it is down, it's likely to be down more than 10%. So if you're invested in the stock market, you're not going to expect to get 6, 7, 8% per year. It's going to be lumpy and your returns are going to be potentially big in 1 year. Because you saw we had 20% returns per year for the 3 years leading up to this year. And then now this year we're down more than 20%. Mm. And so I think that sort of lumpiness is inherent in the stock market. And you have to expect that there's going to be periods where after really good above average returns, you're probably going to get some below average returns for a while. But strangely, our business tends to pick up during a bear market, which is bizarre. So our business is managing wealth for families and institutions. And one of the ways in which people make decisions to change to a different financial advisor or change their investment strategy is typically there's two big things. One is a life event, right? You get an inheritance, you get married, you're buying a house, something happens in your life where you get to the retirement age and you go, all right, I've done this on my own for a while. I think I need to have someone else take the steering wheel and I'm just going to let someone else help me do that stuff. And the other thing I think is, especially in a bear market, people are much more willing to make a change. Because in a bull market, obviously, there's different range of results in terms of how you're doing. But, you know, in a bull market, not many people make changes to their portfolio or to their advisor because things are going well in something in their portfolio, right? If when things are going well.
Right. Everyone looks smart.
Yeah, everyone looks smart. There's obviously always FOMO and people doing better than you, but it's easy to look smart during a bull market. So when they know they want to get a change and maybe they have an advisor who didn't prepare them for the fact that bear markets are part of the game when investing in risk assets, and they didn't set their asset allocation that matched their risk profile and time horizon. So we see a lot of changes in that sort of thing during a bear market. And so we end up getting a lot busier. So as a business, that's when we prepare for these kind of things because we think that's when people are going to come to us and look for some more guidance in these times. And it's almost like a slingshot effect where you get more clients coming in, even though assets are down. It's already the longest bear market we've had since 2008. And so preparing people for that and getting ready to take advantage of that as a business is something we think about.
Yeah, it's like a Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Everybody thinks they can do it until they learn that they can't and they try to find somebody who's actually professional. So you guys are counter-cyclical. So like what to invest in a downturn? Ritholtz.
I think so. I think that's just the nature of our business. And we had always thought that and didn't really get too many times to test it because for 10 years, we had some corrections and stuff along the way, but nothing to really get people. And we think the pandemic was the first thing that really tested that. And this is another time for that.
Okay. So people show up and people are usually probably asking you two things, like what's smart and what's dumb. So what do you see? Not so much what you advise, but like you've probably seen some wild stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest thing that a lot of people come to you and say, all right, here's my portfolio. I want you to pick 10 stocks for me. And the other thing is they'll say that, but then they'll say, I'm going to put money with four different advisors. And whoever has the best performance over the next 12 months, that's who I'm going to give all my money to. And you think, oh, performance, that makes sense. Whoever has the best performance wins. But then you take a step back and realize, like, you're incentivizing an advisor to take ridiculous risks with your money because they could take a lot of risk and try to go for the grand slam. And if they hit that grand slam, then they're going to get all your money, so they win. And if they fail and they lose you a bunch of money, it was only a little bit of money anyway, and they're going to go with someone else anyway. So by having that sort of mentality of whoever has the best performance over this short time period, you don't realize the types of risks that you're opening yourself up to. The other thing we tell people that come to us is, yes, the securities you select at the end of the day, it makes a difference in your performance. But the thing that really matters is, like, how are your assets allocated across different strategies and asset classes and sectors? And then how does that asset allocation fit with your goals and what you want to get out of your life? I think some people just realize the peace of mind you get from outsourcing is worth it. And that's sort of helpful in the end too.
Yeah. The other thing I think about, we manage money on behalf of a lot of investors as well. Specialized strategy. We're a registered investment advisor. The best advisors really, you're buying straight talk. And so the challenge for us and probably for you is that when things are going great, like 2021, we wanted to start hoarding cash and leaning back and telling everybody, like, oh, this is scary. We have a fund that's like an income fund. And so it has a current yield. And that current yield falling in 2021 as we just started moving to low risk assets or cash. And at one point, we had investors giving us, like, our yield had fallen, I don't know what it was, 4%. And they're like, that's terrible. But what happened is if we'd held assets, they would have repriced down like 10, 20%. And so it's like you're punished for doing the right thing in the short run. In the beginning, when we invented this concept, you can invest in specific real estate deals. We had about 1,000 sort of high net worth investors. And I had a view that was a fragile model, that you really needed to have a portfolio. You need to be able to have cash. And we basically said, we're going to shut down the business, move to this portfolio model, a fund model, where you're basically all about picking a strategy. And we lost half our customers. So at the time, this is like, now I have 380,000 customers, but we had 1,000 at the time, which was like a lot for us. And we lost half of them because they all wanted to pick buildings, pick stock. And we ended up picking our business that we thought, in the same way you would fire a customer who's just what they want from you is not what you want to provide.
Yeah, that must have been tough at the time, but that's the right choice to do the kind of business that you want to do. And I think the thing is, if someone wants that, they can probably get that somewhere else, but just laying it out to people that this is how we're going to do it and how we would like to do it. And I think transparency, like you said, is a big part of it too. Just anyone can sell a story and get someone's foot in the door, but to keep a client, then you have to actually deliver on what you said you were going to do. And I think that's the biggest part of it too, is following through on what those expectations you set for someone, and then you go out and do it.
Okay, let's go back to like the world we're in now. So we're in a world of instability, right? What are you watching most closely, whether catalysts or are there specific things you think are most important to keep your eye on?
It's interesting because especially like 2020, early 2021, the stock market was way more exciting than the economy. I think that's flipped now where the economy is way more interesting than the stock market. And these two things are never perfectly in line with one another. The stock market is always trying to front run or overreact or underreact to things. And so it's rarely lined up. I think it is kind of ironic that the unemployment rate was going to above 14% in like April 2020 as the stock market was shooting higher. It had already bottomed and moved past it. And now the unemployment rate is down to 3.5% and the stock market is crashing and it's the opposite direction. So I think the economic stuff is interesting. Obviously, it seems like the only thing that matters right now is inflation and the Fed. It's kind of unfortunate that the Fed is dictating so much of what happens to the market, especially in the short to intermediate term. I think that's probably the only thing that really matters is what the Fed does and what they say. And for me, being a more numbers-driven person, it's hard to wrap my head around the importance of that right now, because obviously in the long term, I think that it probably all sort of irons out and it's not quite as big of a deal. But in terms of how the market shakes out, the way inflation reacts in the coming months to the Fed's interest rate hikes, I think that's the biggest story right now.
The problem is that the Fed can make mistakes.
I think that's probably the biggest risk right now is a policy error. And I think the Fed is way better during a crisis at stopping a crisis in its track. Like the 2020, I think what they did made a lot of sense at the time. They obviously overstayed their welcome, but what they did to unclog the pipes of the financial system in 2020 to make sure that we didn't have this calamity at the same time as a pandemic on the financial markets, I think that made sense. I think what we're learning is that they are not nearly as good as knowing how to hit the brakes or how to tap the brakes or when to tap them. And obviously, they overstayed their welcome by buying mortgage-backed bonds too long. Now, the other thing is, to humans, you're right. I think a lot of economists for years had assumed people are rational. If we just assume a rational model, if we pull A, B will happen. And the problem is that the Fed could want people to think a certain way and think, listen, we're going to be tighter monetary policy for the next 6 months. And after that 6 months, we're going to lighten up and hopefully that'll loosen financial conditions. But until then, it's bad. But they don't realize that investors could hear that phrase and go, okay, so in 6 more months of pain, then the Fed's going to lighten up. So we're just going to skip that 6 months and front run it now. So the reaction to the news or the headlines is often more important than the news or headlines itself. So, and you never know what investors are pricing in at any one point. I don't know, is 25% fall in the stock market or 35% in the NASDAQ, is that enough to account for a potential recession and the Fed raising rates to 4 or 5%? It could be. It also could be that a recession happens in the future and then the stock market gets worse because you just never know what's been pulled forward or what is already baked into the price.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons I am a real estate investor because you can invest in like real assets and understand its pricing at least. Obviously, it gets affected by the base interest rates and healthy economy, but it's like a building costs $150 a square foot to build.
I do think that's one of the things that I've probably changed my mind on the most is how good of a deal owning a house is. I mean, take away the 50% gains we've seen in the last few years. That was just, obviously you can't plan on stuff like that happening. But I think if you think about a house, the fact that it doesn't trade on a daily basis and you get tax breaks from the interest on it, I think I probably underestimated how important housing is to like the middle class and the majority of Americans. Because whatever the home ownership rate is 2/3 in this country. I don't think people realize how good of a deal they've had it with housing. I think the housing market crash of 2007, 2008 probably changed a lot of people's minds and when people overextended themselves. But as long as you're reasonable with finding a house that you can actually afford and fixing a payment, I think one of the biggest positives about housing in this cycle is just what a great inflation hedge it's been.
Right.
That's the one thing people probably didn't think of. Not only from the fact that housing tends to rise when inflation rises because input costs and that sort of thing, but if you've fixed your payment for 30 years and inflation goes up to 8 or 9%, every month you're paying with dollars that are worth less. And it's a great inflation hedge from having just that fixed payment over time that doesn't rise. And so I think for individuals, just having a home as part of a big part of their net worth has probably saved a lot more people than realized in these past few years in terms of it's by far been their best performing asset.
Yeah, on a nominal basis, real estate did a lot better than stocks in the 70s. I don't know if this is like the 70s because we have a lot more debt globally and domestically, which is, I think, going to really constrain our ability to raise rates. Rates went to 20% in 1981, you know, on a federal debt of, what is that, like $26 trillion of debt or something?
Right.
20% would be $5 trillion a year of debt service. So I think the Fed is terrified that they won't be able to tame inflation with 5% rates. And the Fed's decisions are partly psychological and partly political, not just economic, and leaves us handicapped in our ability to make good forecasts in terms of what to invest in and what to build, what to sell, because there's just a massive amount of uncertainty.
Yeah, the cycles they're moving way faster. And yeah, the Fed is probably making that. I agree with your point about the so much debt. That's a worry at some point that we incurred so much debt and then we increased it during the pandemic, which again, I think made sense at the time. But that's much easier to stomach when you have government bonds at 2% than when they're 4 or 5%, because then the interest cost gets way higher. And so that's the competing thing with me, where I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around the fact that we didn't invest enough in our energy infrastructure, so that could keep inflation high for a while. But we also have to deal with the fact that debt and government debt is so high that it's going to be hard for them to keep rates high for very long because of the fact that they're paying such high interest levels on that debt. But to your point, I think if you can detach yourself from the fact that this stuff impacts people on a personal level and people are losing money and that's never fun, I think it's endlessly fascinating to see these cycles and how quickly they're happening and what happens when you pull this lever and how people react to this. So I think this is just like one of the greatest games around in terms of financial markets and how things react and what's going to happen, because you think historically when A has happened, B has happened. But this time around, things are so jumbled and messed up that those relationships, you can probably throw them all out the window, because we've certainly never seen something like this where the pandemic just totally gave us a regime change and a pivot in the economy and the markets unlike anything we've seen in a long, long time, that a lot of those historical relationships just probably aren't going to hold like they once did.
Well, Ben, thanks for coming on. It was awesome. So where can our listeners find you if they want to hear more?
Yeah, just my blog is A Wealth of Common Sense. I write there a few times a week. And then podcast is Animal Spirits. You can find it on the blog as well.
Oh, excellent. Well, this was sensational. Thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, Ben.
You've been listening to Onward, Fundrise podcast featuring Ben Carlson, Director of Institutional Asset Management at Ritholtz. My name is Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise, and we invite you again to send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. If you like what you heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise-sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. This podcast was produced by Seaplane Armada, which also did our music. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next episode.